I call this meeting of House Finance to order. Let the record reflect that it's 1:34 p.m. on Wednesday, March 8th, 2023. With us today, we have Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Stapp, Representative Colomb, Representative Ortiz, Representative Pront, Representative Tomaszewski, Co-Chair Edgman, Co-Chair Foster, myself, Co-Chair Johnson. Assisting us today, we have the LIO moderator, Emma Turner, and the Finance Secretary, Leah Frazier. We have two items on the agenda today. First, we'll hear a budget overview from the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. And we appreciate them coming, and we have a shortened period of time for the department. And I know that they're aware of that, so we appreciate them coming and going through their department overview in an efficient manner. Presenting for DCCED will be Julie Sanders. Commissioner for DCCED, Michaela Fowler, Deputy Commissioner, Hannah Lager, Administrative Services Director. Commissioner Sandy, would you like to come forward, put yourself on the record, and introduce any staff that you would like to have come and present with you?
Good afternoon. Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Julie Sandy, and I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. And with me, I have the Deputy Commissioner of the Department, as well as Hannah Lager. Director Lager is our ASD and guru on all things numbers, and so we're grateful to have her here. I do understand that we have a reduced bit of time today, and so we're going to try to be as succinct and brief as we can be. And if we're too quick or too brief on something, please let us know. I also just wanted to call out that joined in the room this afternoon. We, as you guys have a full house, so do I, which makes me proud. We've got lots of folks here today from the department. So we have Greg Smith, who's our ledge liaison, Catherine Fritz, who's our budget analyst, Jeremy Woodrow from ASME, the director of ASME, Sylvan Robb, who is our director of CBPL. And today we are also joined by Randy Roro, familiar face to many of you, I'm sure, as the executive director for ADA. In addition to that, we are joined online by lots of folks, division directors and executive directors of the corporation. So with that, we'll get started. Oh, thank you.
And I just wanted to make note, we're at 30 pages. So what I'm going to request is that we may stop about halfway through to take some questions. So if you have a particular stopping point about halfway through, otherwise I'll just find one, I suppose. So, yeah, thank you.
So I have the easy part. I just get the honor of introducing myself and representing our team. I know every commissioner feels this way, but I really do think I have the ability to represent a really special group of folks, really proud of the Department of Commerce and all of the things that we do within the department. It's a remarkable spectrum of services, and we serve across hundreds of communities throughout the state of Alaska, serving thousands of Alaskans, and we're really proud of that. But our mission and why we serve is to promote a healthy economy, strong communities, and protect consumers in Alaska. And we do that through our executive team, our 8 corporate agencies, and our 7 core divisions. And so I know I met many of you just about a year ago now, and I was so new, I didn't even know what I didn't know, but it's just within the 7 core divisions, when you don't count the corporate agencies, it covers a lot. So this slide, although it's painfully busy, the reason why it's important to have this here is just really we wanted to represent for folks how we achieve our mission across our agencies and across the services that we provide. And I can tell you, a year ago when I started, I was looking at some of the program services or the titles, and I was thinking to myself, how on earth or why on earth is that even under commerce? But really quickly, once you dive into the services that they're providing and you see the ways in which they impact Alaskan lives, it's really easy to see how each one of those services is working to do exactly what we intend to do with our missions in promoting a healthy economy, strong communities, and protecting consumers. A really great way or example of that is Division of Banking and Securities, how their financial institution examiners and their ANCSA election proxies, and then also their cryptocurrency multi-state oversight is just one of those ways in which one division is impacting the mission in all of the separate ways, and they're all intertwined. And so it was an important slide, and I know it's painfully busy, but. And then this is just, and again, very briefly, this is our department structure. So you can see in the gray boxes under the, we have the commissioner's office and then all of the core services in the divisions we've added this year. So a year ago when I was presenting, I was just announcing that we were going to be taking on the broadband office under Commerce and introducing the Alaskan Broadband Office, which is now one of our divisions. And then also under that, we have our, in the yellow boxes, all, those are the corporate agencies under Commerce. And then next, I'm going to hand it off to Director Lager, who is an expert in all things budget related. And but by all means, when you guys have questions, please let me know.
Great, thank you. For the record, Hannah Lager, Administrative Services Director for the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. So I know there is also a lot on this slide, but this provides a big picture view of the department's overall budget through a couple of different slices. Looking at the chart in the upper right-hand corner, you can see through the number of callouts on there that Commerce is home to a number of special appropriations over the year, and that can make looking at year-to-year actuals a little challenging. The large jump in federal authority, that big gray bar at the top, primarily relates to $185 million that we received of federal ARPA funding for local communities in 22 that just shows up in our budget in a few different places. Looking at the chart in the upper left-hand corner, I want to highlight that big yellow slice for you, the big gray slice, and then the smaller blue slice. So the department is primarily funded by designated general funds. For us, that's things like license fees collected from professional licenses, business licenses, insurance licensees, banking licensees. We get a lot of different sources for that. The big gray slice is other funds. So that's interagency receipts, that's AEA receipts for the Alaska Energy Authority, it's Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority receipts, wide variety of funds that come in there. But that little blue slice is the general fund for us. So we collect a lot of money in a variety of different funding sources, but we're a pretty small consumer of state general funds. Looking back at our prior year history, this slide goes back to 2015, and it really does just demonstrate how our budget has changed over time. You can see there are a number of those kind of special projects in the callouts in there, as well as how our general fund has declined over the years. We used to have large tourism marketing contracts. Those aren't occurring in our budget anymore. They've moved over to capital. And we've also worked on just reducing our general fund consumption over time. And we get to my favorite slide, which I have to give credit to OMB for they created this one. But just to put the rest of the presentation in perspective, Commerce is the smallest bar on this chart. So we're a small portion. We do a lot of things, as the commissioner mentioned. We have a lot of different responsibilities, but a fairly small portion of the budget. Moving on to our executive team. So this is the commissioner's office, and in there we have the Alaska Broadband Office, as the commissioner mentioned. We also have the Office of International Trade, so that's something that's been new in our budget in the last few years. We do legislative relations. Economic development activities are all spearheaded out of the commissioner's office, as well as managing a number of different boards and commissions. We have dozens of them in the department. And special projects, things like Food Security Task Force and things like that are all headed up out of the commissioner's office. Jumping into the commissioner's office budget, I'm just going to hit kind of the high points on each of these since I know we have a lot of records and limited time in here. But we are trying to position ourselves, and this is something you'll see throughout the budget, where we're trying to make sure that we are positioned to accept additional sources of funding from the federal government or non-state, non-federal sources for different projects as we go forward. So we're adding some federal receipt authority in the commissioner's office so that we can look at things like state trade expansion program grants and other federal opportunities. We're also just budgeting a couple of positions that we created to recognize that we need a little bit more staff capacity in the commissioner's office, a position to help us manage our boards and a position for additional executive support. Moving on to administrative services, we don't actually have any budget changes this year, but what I did want to reflect is that the governor's amended budget does include salary and health adjustments department-wide, and so we just included the total here on this slide. I mentioned earlier that we collect a lot of different sources of revenue, and I just wanted to highlight that In addition to collecting it, we don't spend all of it. We contribute a significant portion to the actual big general fund every year. In FY 2022, that was a little over $100 million from a variety of sources, the largest of which certainly is insurance premium taxes collected by our Division of Insurance. The Alaska Broadband Office, there is a lot to talk about here, and we're very excited about it. They really are working ahead to make sure that we are meeting all of our federal requirements to bring in that broadband funding to benefit Alaska. So we're working ahead, as I mentioned, trying to be well-positioned for that money coming in. We think the large influx of cash is going to be in that fiscal year 2025 budget, so next year we'll be coming back to talk about that. But we're making sure that we are developing that office in a way that will have us adequately staffed to do that. So in the 2024 budget, we are budgeting our tribal liaison position that we created, and that's as we look at the wide variety of federal funding coming in to different tribal entities, to the state. We want to make sure that the efforts that we are doing are not duplicative, that they're complementary, and that we're really making sure that we're working together with other partners to leverage that funding appropriately across the state. We are also adding some funding for broadband grants management support. We're going to put grants administrators with our other grants administrators in the Division of Community and Regional Affairs, so you'll see the positions associated with that funding pop up later, but we're going to pay for it from the broadband office. And then, as I mentioned, making sure that we're well-positioned for the future, we're adding some receipt or some language in the budget for statutory-designated program receipts. So that's if a non-state, non-federal partner wanted to help participate in broadband. We had an instance of that earlier this year where we had to jump through some administrative hoops to make sure that we could receive that funding. So making sure we're set up to receive that, and then adding some federal receipt authority. So we are doing everything that we can to be first in line for that broadband funding, to get our applications in early, to make sure that Alaska is what everybody else is compared to, which is going to be great. We think that's going to come in 2025, but we do want to make sure that if it comes in a couple months earlier than we think it is, that we're ready to hit the ground running. On to the Division of Banking and Securities. They have a lot going on this year. We're seeing significant growth in the financial sector and in their budget this year. We are adding funding for increased legal costs as well as for a financial examiner four to assist with investigations and enforcement. That really is as the financial sector is growing and as there are new and novel financial instruments out there, there's areas where Alaskans need more protection and we need additional enforcement staff for that. On to the Division of Community and Regional Affairs, which is our community powerhouse in the department. They really do a whole lot of different stuff for communities, everything from literally helping to teach bookkeeping software, to issuing grants, a wide variety of services there. So in the 2024 budget, we are adding two positions, no funding associated with them, just the positions. We're able to leverage additional federal receipt authority that we already had and increase those grants to fund additional staff. We're also adding a grants administration manager. We've seen our grant portfolio grow. We're just under $1 billion in grants last year. We got 870 new grants to go out for our eight existing staff. So it's a pretty heavy grants workload, and we just need one additional position to assist with that. And then, as I mentioned, there's the grant administrators in here for the broadband office. So we're going to put our new positions with the experts in the broadband office. We'll pay for them through an interagency agreement. Also in the Division of Community and Regional Affairs, these are already included in the base, but I know this is a common area of interest, so we've included it. There are a number of grants to named recipients that we do pay out of our operating budget. So there are two grants to Alaska Legal Services, one from general funds, one from civil legal services funds, which are court filing fees that are collected. There's one to the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, one to Life Alaska Donor Services, and one for the Kuskokwim Ice Road. Those amounts are unchanged from the prior year, with the exception of Alaska Legal Services Corporation, which is a formula based on those court filing fees that are collected. Onto the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. So as the commissioner mentioned, they touch the lives of almost every Alaskan in some way. They have over 300,000 licensees across business licensing, professional licensing, corporations. There's a lot of activity that goes on in this division, and they have seen professional licensing activity grow by 64% over the last 10 years. So we're definitely seeing growth in this division. In their budget in fiscal year 2024, the biggest change that we're making is we're changing how we're using general fund in this component. So over the last couple of years, we have used general funds to offset programs that would be in deficit. So when we reviewed their fees, they would be in the hole and they'd have to be making up funding. We've used general fund in the past to offset that. In 2024, we're changing that approach, and instead, we're going to use general funds to offset investigative costs. We've looked at where we see variability and instability in those fee calculations, and it really is investigative costs, where you have a small program and a large investigative cost, and then that large cost gets spread to a very small pool of licensees. Some of them are larger, but that's where we see the fees kind of yo-yo a little bit, or a roller coaster effect. So we're going to take those investigative fees off the table. We're going to pay for them out of general fund, and that's going to remove that instability from the fee-setting process. And that really, it also reflects that many of the investigations we do are for things like unlicensed practice, right, where it's not the law-abiding licensee who is doing the bad activity. It's somebody who's not even part of their licensing pool, but they're paying for it right now. The other thing that we are doing in here is we're restoring some computer refresh funding. That's just last year we had laptops that we purchased through CARES funds years ago now that we didn't need to refresh, but we're going to need to refresh them and get back on that schedule next year. In the 2024 governor amended budget, we are also adding some staff and some receipt authority to address that really significant growth in license activity and professional licensing. As I mentioned, they've grown 64% over 10 years. Their staffing level has grown about 40%, so it's a little bit of a catch-up to help get them adequately staffed for the volume that they're seeing. Moving on to the Division of Insurance. The big highlight here, as we mentioned before, we collect a lot of revenue. Much of what we collect is collected in the Division of Insurance, just about just under $65 million in 2022. In the FY 2024 budget, the first thing we're doing is actually a 2023 supplemental budget item, which is extending the Alaska Reinsurance Program match. We've been successful in extending that program for another 5 years, which is very exciting. That program really helps to lower the cost of private health insurance in the state. And we have to keep the terms of the original federal waiver, which was that we have some match involved. So extending that multi-year. And then in 2024, we are adding $1 million of their existing receipt authority for actuarial costs. This is similar to an increase that we saw in 2023 as well. We would love to be able to hire actuaries. We are actively recruiting for them. In the meantime, we have to use contractual services, and those are more expensive. Moving on to the Division of Investments. No budget changes for them, but I really did want to make sure that we mentioned that they serve a really important role in economic development in the state, in helping people and businesses get loans through fishing programs, through small business loan programs. They have a full underwriting software in that division. They work with so many individuals who have trouble getting financing in other programs through traditional banks and really help people participate in the economy that way.
All right, let's go ahead and take a little break right there and see if we have any questions from the committee. Representative Hannon.
Thank you. I got to find on slide 14. Thank you, Chair Johnson. The banking and securities adding a position for an investigator and examiner at $481,000. And I'm guessing I want to just know the breakout between what's the personal services cost and what's the investigation cost.
Absolutely. Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Hannon, that includes $275,000 of legal costs. As we're doing more investigations, we're definitely incurring more legal fees. We have seen some stories in the news about recent activities and enforcement activities we've taken on, and then the balance is for that personal services cost. So the bulk of it is legal costs.
Okay. And one follow-up?
Follow-up.
All right. Through the chair, is this it's a new position. Do we already have someone with a similar background? We can't hire an actuarial. Are there financial examiner investigators out there on the market that we can hire, or do we have someone in-house to move up to this?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Hannon, this position will live in their small enforcement unit, and it will be the upper level of their very small, I think it's a two-person enforcement unit right now. So we do anticipate that there will be promotional opportunities as we recruit for that position.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hannon. Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. Through the chair, cryptocurrency multi-state oversight. Can you expand on that just a little bit?
Through the chair, Representative, I actually think we may want to, for the record, my name is Michaela Fowler. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department, and we do have Director Schmidt online. And I believe he would be very excited to be able to speak to you in more detail on that topic.
This is Director Rob Schmidt. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, hi. Through the chair, my name is Rob Schmidt. I'm the Director of the Division of Banking and Securities. In 2022, we saw a spectacular series of cryptocurrency bankruptcies. Those cryptocurrencies impacted thousands of Alaska accounts to the tune of tens of millions of dollars. We have a significant amount of staff effort being expended monitoring those bankruptcies, ensuring the appropriate oversight of those bankruptcies, hopefully the return of funds to the investors, and making sure that the successor entities do a better job of running their business than the prior entities did. But I'd say that we've got many hundreds of staff hours, if not over 1,000 staff hours, that we spent monitoring these cryptocurrency bankruptcies.
And follow-up?
Follow-up for Representative Tomaszewski.
Yeah, and just if you could, do you work with at all with the Permanent Fund Dividend Corporation and their cryptocurrency and what they have done there? Thanks.
No, through the chair, no, we do not.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We have Representative Ortiz followed by Representative Palom.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the chair. If we could go to slide 21. I'd like to know a little bit more about the mechanics of how it happens. I think it's a good thing, obviously. It's a good, very good thing. The bottom bullet there, Department of Insurance deposited nearly $65 million into the general fund in FY22. And then you have the Gold Star, nearly $400 million federal funds collected 2016 to 2023. What happens in the process in the Division of Insurance, which allows that division to generate that kind of money for the general fund? How does that work?
Absolutely. Thank you. Through the chair, there are two separate items that generate those revenues. So the big gold star in there relates to our Alaska reinsurance program. So through that waiver, that five-year waiver that we've just gotten extended through 2027, we've already collected nearly $400 million that's come into the state and offset the cost of private health insurance in the state. The second item on there is the $65 million that goes into the general fund, and that's generated from insurance premium taxes. So every time you pay an insurance bill, anybody pays an insurance bill in the state, there's a small percentage added onto that. That's the insurance premium tax. So for most things, that's 2.7. There are some lines, or 2.7%. There are some lines that are just a little bit higher, I think 3.25% for wet marine or something like that. But so it's just a small add-on on every insurance policy.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Colm. To that point, we have Representative Staff that would like to make a comment.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to the folks at our wonderful Division Administration. Can you clarify that $400 million, does that actually go in the State General Fund?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative, it does not go into the State General Fund. It's collected by the state, and then it's issued out as a grant to our Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, which administers the Alaska Reinsurance Program.
Yeah, follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Stapp.
Right. And just for clarification's sake, and that money goes to basically lower individuals' insurance premiums through the healthcare marketplace. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, that is correct.
All right, thank you. Next up, we have Representative Colm.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair. So I'm on page 18.
You have a square there for professional licensing. I know that we have, or I have gotten a lot of complaints about the time it takes to get a license in Alaska. And I know you're not doing all the licensings, but 45 programs, you're doing the bulk of it. Can you speak to how long it's taking, what you're doing to kind of resolve those delay issues?
Thank you, through the chair. I appreciate that question. And I can tell you, a year ago when I started, one of the more humorous points was, as I was walking around trying to meet everybody, I kept hearing from folks in this building that there was a lot of dissension and not everybody got along or saw eye to eye, and there certainly wasn't one thing you all agreed upon. And after I had an opportunity to meet everybody, I came back and said, there is one point you all agree on, and that appears to be that nobody's happy with corporations, businesses, and professional licensing and the time it takes to get a license. So it was one of the things that I knew was going to be a priority when I first started, and we had to really drill down. And the folks in this building did a great job representing the constituents' interests and complaints, and that was certainly what you all were hearing in your communities, and it was of grave concern to us as well. If, you know, in hindsight, if we knew that there was going to be a 64% increase over 10 years, it's very likely that the division would have staffed up appropriately or made changes to the programs to be able to respond to that. Instead, I think what you would see is there was a very small growth in staffing, and what started to happen in what I call in our private businesses really is the death spiral then, because as you've added more workload to folks and people start to turn over in the positions, then you've got empty seats sitting next to you, and then that continues in terms of folks just being really dissatisfied with the work that they're doing. And these are folks that have worked incredibly hard and are very faithful to the mission and really dedicated and loyal. And so I think the heartbreak for me, and I wasn't here at that time, but when I came on board, I really saw that the team was really fragmented and frustrated. And so we've been able to do a lot of things that I'm very proud of. One of the things that I committed to all the folks in this room that were here then, and then also to my boss, was just we can do a lot of things that really quickly, and then there's some long-term fixes. What I really appreciated was the commitment from the folks in the legislature and then also in the governor's office to give our division what we needed to be able to make those fixes. So we've got some long-term and short-term recommendations, and a lot of the short-term things we've already implemented, I'm really, really proud of, and we've made some huge gains, one of which was when I sat here a year ago, vacancy rate at that time was above 22%, I think, and right now we're right around 12%. And in this environment, and everybody knows how workforce is really, really tight, that's a tremendous gain. So I'm proud, and I'm proud of the folks that have hung in there, and again, Sylvan Director Robb's come on board, and so we are really heading in the right direction. And the last thing I would offer about it is when we are doing something well, I don't expect constituents to call you and let you know. So I would just ask that one measurement tool you might use is hopefully what you will start to find is less frequency in the calls. And I think that that's what we're finding already.
Can I have a follow-up?
One follow-up.
So with more personnel, is that impacting the delay? And can you tell me about what the delay of the licenses are? Is there information that I could look up to see how long it's taking to get licenses out the door?
Through the chair, for the record, Michaela Fowler, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Commerce. Each licensing program has a different time for delay. We're at about 8 weeks for the initial review of a new nurse license right now. And that's not issuance of a license. That's 8 weeks after we receive that paperwork, is it reviewed to ensure that it is complete. There are four things I'd like to quickly highlight. I know we're short on time, but that we are doing to address the delays in CDPL. One of which is, if you'll see in the governor's amended budget, there are 12 additional positions. One of which is we are working on a classification study, recognizing that being able to retain employees is really important for our ability to improve our response times to professional license applications. And so we need to make sure that our positions are properly classified so that there's career advancement opportunities within CBPL and we can retain that talent. Another item that I want to raise there is that we've created a board liaison position in the commissioner's office, and that's really important because our boards have a lot of authority over the criteria for licensure, and if we don't have an effective board, it's really easy for us to have pretty disjointed and cumbersome processes that we're asking licensees to go through. And then the last item is universal temporary licensure, which is legislation that the governor proposed this year. We're really excited about it, and it's going to provide us an avenue to say, okay, if you're coming in from another state where you're licensed and the license criteria in that other state is substantially similar to ours, you can start working. We're going to issue you a temporary license once we've done sort of that preliminary check, and then you can get to work while we get through all of the rest of that processing because we recognize we need to get people to work faster.
Thank you.
Representative Cronk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, go back to page four. There's two areas. I you don't have to explain a lot of time. So we got the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute and the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation. I probably know the answer, but what exactly are they doing?
So through the chair, thank you. So the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. And Jeremy Woodrow is here, and I'm so grateful that I'm able to serve on that board because I can really see, in my mind, that is a perfect example of what the industries should have in terms of they've got a very dedicated and talented board. Those folks are really the leaders within their industries, but in addition to that, they have the committees that are volunteers. They're top talent within a lot of the heavy hitters within the industry. They've dedicated to be serving in a volunteer status, to be working on those, and then feeding information up to the boards, and then they're able to really impact marketing seafood. But what I always say and I love about it is they're not just marketing seafood, they're marketing Alaska. So they do an incredible job, top talent team of folks, but they are worldwide, have relationships and contracts, but in addition are just domestically really helping to move that industry forward in what I consider to be a really remarkable way. And in addition to that, really just helping to market Alaska, not just Alaskan seafoods.
Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
Gasoline.
You want to take that one?
I'll let you. So, and I actually believe we have Frank Richards on the phone. Is that accurate?
I believe we do.
So, I mean, I'm happy to sort of give you sort of the intro to AGDC, but you may be more pleased with the answer you get directly from Mr. Richards.
Is it, are you, that clarify everything?
Like, I'm good for now. I'm good for now. Thank you.
All right. Very good. Thank you. All right. If I'm seeing no additional questions, apparently I missed one there. Representative Josephson.
Sure. Just moving quickly through the PowerPoint. I see $6 million in receipts from ADA. That seems lower than I've seen in the past. Is that something that can be explained?
Yes. Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the $6 million that's shown for ADA in receipts in fiscal year 2022 is their dividend. In some years, that dividend is directly appropriated out, but in fiscal year 2022, it just went to the general fund.
Follow up?
Yes, but I wanted to just make a reminder to put your name on the record so we can follow who's speaking in the future. Thank you.
Through the chair, I meant to say dividend, but again, I've seen numbers, I think, substantially higher than a $6 million dividend in a fiscal year from ADA to the state. Am I right about that?
Thank you. For the record, Hannah Lager, Administrative Services Director for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, the dividend amount has certainly varied. There's a statutory range between 25 and 50% of, I believe, the statutory net earnings for the prior year, and it is declared by the board every year.
Okay. Next question, if I might.
yes, on Representative Josephson.
On slide 18, the 64% increase in licenses, my guess is that's mostly due to the creation of new professions in a formal, structured way. Am I right about that? And remind us what those were. I know there's like a medical assistant, and there was a new type of LPN, or that sort of thing.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, there have been a few
additional programs. I think I would have to follow up with what those specific ones were, but I would say we have seen growth in established programs. It's not only new programs. It is increase in that activity.
It's a remarkable number. Thank you.
And for the record, that was Ms. Lager. All right. I think that might be the time to move to the next section. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. For the record, Hannah Lager, Administrative Services Director. So now we're going to talk about our corporate entities. We've consolidated these into just a couple of slides, so this should go just a little bit faster. But as you can see, our eight are displayed on there. I would note we do have the Alaska Railroad Corporation on there. They do fall under the Department for Administrative Purposes, but they're not subject to the Executive Budget Act, so we don't have any budget materials in the information before you. In our corporate agencies this year, we have a couple changes. These are just the highlights. In the Alaska Energy Authority, we are adding five positions and funding for the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. We've received multiple capital appropriations for that, and we just need some staff to support those. The positions are actually housed in the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. So we're adding receipt authority to pull that down that money from capital projects in the Alaska Energy Authority. And then in ADA, which you don't see on this slide, but that's where the actual positions show up for that. We're also adding a power cost equalization technician to help with the community inventory and just additional volume of work in that program. And then in the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, we are replacing funds from the Alaska Liquefied Natural Gas Fund with general funds in fiscal year 2024. The Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation has been primarily funded by their kind of specialized funds for the last number of years. This one was last capitalized in 2016, and they have made remarkable efforts in extending that fund's life. But it's projected to be down to $1.5 million by the end of fiscal year 2023, which is needed for existing contractual obligations in fiscal year 2024. So we're replacing this with general funds. This is going to fund things like personal services, travel, building leases, things like that. Moving on to slide 25, we have the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. And in here, we are adding $5 million in general funds for state support for seafood marketing. ASME does very important work to maximize the value of Alaska seafood, and this recognizes that state participation in that is appropriate and really will help to counter some negative market factors that we're looking for in the following year. Moving on to slide 26, we just have a slide in here about vacancy. We know this has been of interest to a number of members. This is as of January. I would say this number fluctuates a little bit month to month. We've just picked a point in time. We're not super seasonally affected in the department. But if we were to show more months on here, it would look a little bit more jagged. What I would just highlight on here is our vacancy rate, which is that light blue bar at the top, certainly grew throughout the pandemic. And if we were to slice this down to different programs, it impacted different ones in very different ways. In the Division of Corporations and Business and Professional Licensing, as we were discussing earlier, at one point during the pandemic, we saw vacancies in their occupational licensing examiner series as high as 33%, right, which is significant to have a third of that team out. That's certainly, we saw licensing delays as a result of that. Now, their vacancy rate is down to 9% in that job class as of January of 2023. So we are seeing improvements. We are really hyper-focused on those recruitments, making sure that we can get the best candidates in, making sure we can get them on board, and we're doing that across the department. So we are cautiously optimistic about the real progress that we're making, but we are still absolutely hiring. We have jobs out there that we would love to fill. And that gets us to slide 27.
Thank you. So one of the things that when I first came on the team, a theme started to emerge very quickly, and that was as I was meeting with stakeholders, industry leaders, folks from the communities that were flying in to meet you guys, and then also with our office, and going out into the communities, we started to hear the resounding theme whenever I would talk about economic development was, what are we going to do about housing, workforce, and childcare? And very quickly, though I would have liked to have been able to tackle economic development with those issues aside, what really became very clear to me is as we try to address those very, very challenging issues in each of the communities, there's nothing that we're really going to be doing on economic development if we're not also helping to solve those problems for Alaska. and for Alaskans. And so I just wanted to make sure that the high cost of energy is another one we hear a lot about, but I wanted to just call those out as issues that we have been hearing a lot about as we've gone out to talk about what can we do to help economic development in the state of Alaska. So from that, I'm so grateful that I was able to approach the governor in our conversations related to economic development, and he was willing to appropriate $5 million for what really felt to me and our team to be a common sense look at, okay, here's the challenge. How do we best tackle it, knowing that one thing we're really, really proud of at the department is being good stewards of state dollars. And so I think when you look at that increase of 870 grants for a team of eight people, that's one example of that. Another is, you know, these two ladies sitting next to me would never tell you this, but the most remarkable job when I first started a year ago and came on, and again, I coming from the private sector, it sort of felt like crickets in a state office building. I'm looking at empty offices and empty seats. The business owner in me is thinking, you know, how much per square foot could I charge to someone else? And what is the state losing if that's happening across the state? So, but what I loved about it was when we started to talk about things like, wait, if we don't have the same need that we once did for commercial real estate, how can we help? And how can we be better stewards of state dollars? And so the folks on our team took that on, and it was no small lift. But and I can't compliment our team enough for being flexible and willing to say, okay, it sort of might cramp my style a little bit, but I'm willing to share my office or my space with someone else. The Department of Education just happened to be coming up on their lease renewal, and so we were able to invite the Department of Education to move onto our floor. So the office next to me is now the commissioner for the Department of Education. Today I couldn't help it. Like I get warm fuzzies because I'm walking through there, and it feels like it's just such a busy little place now, really great energy, and there's a lot of synergistic opportunities in that. So it's just one example, but nobody's going to ever hit them with a headline or a pat on the back about doing a great job, but it was the right thing to do for the state of Alaska. I bring that up to say we face everything with what is best for Alaskans in every decision we make, but also are we being good stewards of state dollars? So teeing up what are we going to do about economic development, and we know we need a strategy. So what I felt like I was able to present to the governor, and I'm so grateful for his support, was an initiative where we could fund it through our own receipts. So that's the other thing. We're not trying to grow state government. What we're acknowledging is we have a need. We need a strategy. My children and hopefully their children's children deserve to have an economic development strategy for the state of Alaska. And so from that, some of these things we're already doing, didn't require an appropriation for. So establishing a sub-cabinet, that was another very clear point that I heard as I spoke to some of you, but then also the community members. When I go to them and talk about economic development, I hear a lot of things about permitting, and I hear about bottlenecks within state services, and I hear that the state agencies maybe aren't working well together or maybe not even aware of what each other is doing. Now that I've done it for a year in the private sector, I would have been the first to probably whine about it. But the reality is, now having been in this position for a year, I can see exactly how that can happen. Folks are very focused on the work that's in front of them. And sometimes we forget to pick our heads up and look around and say, oh my gosh, the commissioner of this department needs help, and we have that to help, but we forgot to offer. So instead, what we started under our department is economic development sub-cabinet. So we're meeting once a week now. I think this week will be our fifth or sixth one. Already the commissioners can tell the difference in terms of how we are checking off a list of what do we need? Do we need to break up in small groups? What information do we need to share, especially as we're talking about big things like broadband and infrastructure? So that's very exciting, and I'm happy about that. And then the next things that we knew we needed to do is engage a public relations firm. So I'm not a marketing expert. We've not hired anybody on our team as marketing experts or PR experts. So we know that that's not an area that we should be looking internally for, but we need professional expertise to help us in that. And then being more strategic, when we talk about having industries come in and inviting folks to come in and do business in Alaska, or incentivizing folks to come in to do business in Alaska, we need to be really targeted and strategic about that approach, because if we just say one thing the governor loves to say is we're open for business, and he's very optimistic about business in Alaska, which I really appreciate. At the same time, we only have so many resources, so if everything's a priority, then nothing is in terms of our team and our energy and our resources. So we want to be very focused about who we're looking at and what makes sense in the culture of Alaska. We plan to benchmark where we are now so that we have an opportunity to come back and you can hold us accountable for our performance. And then stakeholder engagement and steering committees, that's something that the Deputy Commissioner and I have been doing, working and spending a lot of time meeting with folks in the communities and industry leaders, for example, the Chamber of Commerce, to find out what are their observations, where are the needs, and where should we be most focused as we begin the initiative. And then, you know, the last thing is just we want to make sure that we're telling Alaska's story better. We have so much to offer as Alaskans, and so many of us are deeply, deeply proud and passionate about where we come from. And so we just want to make sure that we're really telling that story well.
All right. Well, very, very good. And in interest of time, I will take any questions if someone is very... I have a couple. I see if anybody really has questions that they want to ask, I'd take a couple, but I do need to get to our next presentation. So, all right. Seeing no questions from the committee, we really quite appreciate having you present today on behalf of the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. Thank you. I mean, there's so much there we could have spent a lot of time on. So, anyway, thank you for being before House Finance today. And next up, we'll have a presentation on the long-term forecast of Medicaid enrollment and spending in Alaska. And we will take until 1:25 to switch up the chamber. call this meeting of House Finance back to order. Next up, we have a presentation on the long-term forecast of Medicaid enrollment and spending in Alaska. Presenting, we have Ted Helvoit, Vice President for Evergreen Economics Medicaid Consultants. If you would come forward, place yourself on the record, and welcome to House Finance. You may begin your presentation.
Right. Thank you. And for the record, my name is Ted Helvoit, Vice President, Evergreen Economics, and we're going to talk about long-term forecast of Medicaid. And I'm projecting okay? Okay, great. All right. So let's go to slide two. And I think a little bit of background is really important here for the long-term forecast. And the first forecast was presented in 2006, but it started in the House in 2005. Funds were allocated to do a long-term study of Medicaid enrollment and spending, and the Department of Health and Social Services at that time was asked to solicit bids from competitive contractors, and that contractor was won by the Lewin Group and in teaming with EchoNorthwest to do that study. The reason for that study, between fiscal year 1998 and 2004, Medicaid spending grew by 17% per year, excuse me, 18% per year on average over that period. So the spending in just those 6 years, 1998 to 2004, almost tripled. And so the idea was, the legislature's, your focus was to say, what's going to happen over the long run if this continues, and what's causing it? So that first forecast was completed in 2006 and presented to the legislature, and it's been updated each year since then. It's a 20-year projection. Each projection assumes that the program, Medicaid program, as exists today, is going to exist in the future. Of course, that's not true. There's been a lot of change in the Medicaid program, but it's important to understand, as exists today, what's it going to look like in the future, so that the legislature or the department needs to change things, they can start changing things up. So the forecast does a lot of things. It provides a baseline for the department as they're looking at new initiatives for cost savings. It provides a benchmark for their efforts to bend the Medicaid cost curve, and that's going to be a main theme in this presentation. We're going to start with, and we're going to come back to a couple times. And then it provides insights into Medicaid enrollment, who is enrolling in Medicaid, what services are being utilized, and what's spending now and into the future. I'm not going to cover a lot of that in this presentation, but that's in the report. So let's start with Medicaid and bending the cost curve. And so we're going to look at a set of three graphs that look a lot alike. In this first graph, this is total spending on Medicaid. And so it goes from fiscal year 1998 all the way into the future in the fiscal year 2043. And the red line represents actual spending on Medicaid. The blue dotted line represents that initial forecast. And the green line represents the green dashed line represents the current forecast. As you can see with that initial forecast, the blue dotted line versus the actual spending on Medicaid, when we come out to fiscal year 2022, the last fully completed fiscal year, we're about the Medicaid actual spending is about $1 billion less than was forecast. That's bending the cost curve right there. So that's the point of these slides. That's total spending. Let's go to recipients. So the same theme here. In this case, we're looking at the count of recipients each year. This is the annual unduplicated count of recipients. In Medicaid, often people talk about enrollees. Enrollee is simply someone who's enrolled in Medicaid. A recipient is far more important. A recipient is an individual enrolled in Medicaid and utilizing services. And so that's more important measure or metric to go by. The red line represents actual number of recipients in Medicaid. The blue dotted line, represents that initial forecast from 2006. The green dashed line represents the current forecast. Between when that first forecast was completed through fiscal year 2015, the number of recipients predicted from that forecast and actual was very close. Then there's Medicaid expansion, which drove up the number of recipients beginning in fiscal year 2016. That also coincided with a recession in Alaska and then moved right into the pandemic in beginning in March 2020. the takeaway is there's a lot more recipients in Medicaid today than we projected way back when, back in 2006, about 50,000 more. So let's go to slide six. So slide six looks at spending per recipient. Our first slide looked at total spending. It's much lower. Spending today is much lower than was predicted. The second slide looked at recipients. There are many more recipients today than was predicted. And the only way that those two things can work together is for spending per recipients to be much lower today than was predicted. And that's exactly what this slide six shows. The red line, again, spending per recipient. The blue, in actual. The blue dotted line represents what was predicted. And the green dashed line represents the forecast, this current forecast. And so we're spending about $12,000 per recipient on average. The prediction was about $25,000 by now. And so a few numbers not on this.
Madam Chair, can I quickly ask questions now, or do you want to wait to the end?
I think that I do want to allow people to have opportunities to have questions here. So, let's go ahead and, we'll go ahead and stop maybe every few pages. So this is a few pages in. Sounds good. Representative Ortiz, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the chair. Can you tell me what were the factors that caused the expenditures per recipient to be much less than what was projected? Because I only hear about inflation and medical expenses and things like that. So how did it work out that way?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative. So this is a great place for a question. And I should have mentioned earlier, there's a few slides in here that kind of like we're changing themes or something like that. And that starts the next slide. So this is a great place for questions. From 1998, fiscal year 1998 to 2004, I mentioned that spending was increasing 18% per year. That's total spending. Spending per recipient was increasing by 9% per year over that period of time. From 2006, so after the forecast came out, through 2022, that dropped to 2.2% per year. And from 2012 to 2022, it dropped to 1.6%. So factors, I'm going to get a couple of those. A lot of them would be factors that would be from the legislature in the department, their actions and such that I would not have been personally involved with, would kind of hear about these secondhand. The initial big areas where that bending the cost curve happened was with personal care attendants, was a relatively new service that was, these are my words, maybe not well regulated at the start of like how it works. And so spending was increasing from a few million in, say, 2000, I'm not sure exactly when it began, but 2000, and it increased to 30 or 40 million in just a few years. So controls were put in on the personal care attendants. It's still an important service in Medicaid, but it has grown much slower since then. Right away it dropped and then is increasing very slowly since then. Same type of actions in other parts of the Medicaid program would have happened that would have been controlling costs. And another one would be a slide we're going to look at here a little bit is the Medicaid reimbursement rates. So strong efforts on the part of the department to keep down Medicaid reimbursement rates. And that's a good thing. And that's also not such a good thing. And we'll see why that is. We'll talk about that, why that is here soon. So.
And just quick question. Yeah, and when you use the term spending, who's doing the spending? It may be obvious, but just for the public.
For the record, spending would be the Medicaid program doing the spending. The spending by the Medicaid program of state general fund dollars and federal reimbursement funds. Yes, combination, yes. And we'll look at, there'll be a few slides where we'll look at that breakout between federal and state spending. So obviously that's important. For the forecast, as I do the forecast, I look at spending and then as far as that breakout is all formulaic based on the different FFPs for different eligibility categories and different providers and such. So it's essentially a database or mathematical, calculation type of thing. So
thank you.
All right. Thank you. We have a question, Representative Josephson, followed by Representative Hannon.
Chair, just very quickly on a couple of points you made, and your name is escaping me again, but one more time, sir.
Sure. For the record, Ted Helwig.
Mr. Helwig, you mentioned PCA costs going up, at least for a time in the early part of this century.
Now, even though that someone could be alarmed by that, those costs can be money well spent in that they keep people out of institutions. Is that your understanding?
Through the chair, absolutely. And a very important service, and it isn't the spending on these services. And I'm trying to be a little careful with my words, which I'm not always, the overspending for the services rendered would be the issue. So it isn't definitely not the service. Personal care attendant is still a service category in the Medicaid program. It would be the overspending for the services provided.
Follow-up
Representative Josephson.
You then mentioned keeping down Medicaid reimbursement rates. That has an immediate benefit to the Treasury, but I assume that the mal-effect is that the providers grow unhappy, they shrink in size, and therefore access can be reduced. Do I have that roughly right?
Through the chair, in theory, that seems to be right on for me. I do not know. I had a question from the presentation and Senate Finance of how that affects the number of providers. And that's not something I've looked at. The data are available to do that, and it's something I will do to look at that. So, but definitely the case, as you're holding down the cost of services, and if the cost of services to the Medicaid program, and if the cost of providing those services by the provider are greater than the reimbursement, you're obviously going to lose providers at a certain point. So, and we'll see a slide a few forward here that looks at that issue and just on a year-by-year basis, how that's differed between reimbursement rates versus medical price inflation in Alaska.
Thank you.
Senator Hannan.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Mr. Helvig, help me understand, spending per recipient, you said it was $12,000 average per recipient. Would that be getting $12,000 worth of medical care? I mean, would we equate to, if this was my private insurance, that I was spending $1,000 a month on my insurance covering all my medical needs?
Yeah, through the chair, that's essentially, it may cost more in the private sector to get the same. It'd be more light, most likely. I don't know that for certain, but from my own personal experience with insurance and my understanding of the Medicaid program, my assumption would be those $12,000 spent by the Medicaid program for someone else to get those same services in the private sector, that may have been the combination of insurance premiums plus copay and deductible, maybe in excess of $12,000, so for certain. Yeah. But that is essentially the equivalent of what we're talking about, the services themselves. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hannan. Next up, we have Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, through the chair, Mr. Holwright, just a quick question on the reimbursement rates. When you talk about them being low, is it true that Alaska has the highest Medicaid reimbursement rates under fee-for-service in the nation?
Through the chair, Alaska is certainly one of the highest. So I'm not sure if they're the highest. There's a few states that are much higher than other states, and Alaska would be one of those. I'm not sure if it's first, second, third, fourth.
Yeah, follow-up, Madam Chair. How many states have higher Medicare reimbursement rates than Medicaid?
Through the chair, again, I'm not sure, but it's very few. Yes.
Yeah. And last follow-up.
Yeah.
I think it's one of two states that actually reimburses higher on the Medicaid program, i.e. the state-funded insurance program with federal matching funds, than every other state in the union, minus one. But I'd love to hear your thoughts on that at some point, if you could get back to me. Thanks.
And if I'm just put out a reminder, you to put your name on, just your name on the record each time. Thank you. And seeing no additional questions, go ahead and proceed.
All right. So through the chair, for the record, Ted Helvig, Evergreen Economics. All right. So let's change gears here a little bit and talk about recent trends and events. And the most recent event, of course, is COVID. And this graph shows, slide eight. This graph shows monthly enrollment in Medicaid program in fiscal year 2020 through the end of fiscal year 2022. And the blue represents the pre-COVID or pre-emergency, federal emergency. The orange represents once the emergency was in place. The blue dotted line represents just a simple linear trend to look at where that enrollment growth was going before the emergency, and the orange dashed line represents the trend with the emergency. So as you see, the Medicaid enrollment was increasing. This is, again, monthly average, this or total monthly enrollment. Medicaid, it was ticking up. It was positive. But with the start of the federal health emergency and a continuous enrollment requirement, Medicaid enrollment started increasing very quickly, beginning in probably April or May of 2020. But
we'll wait until we get to the end of the slide.
But largely, that doesn't matter. So the slide 9 shows the spending on Medicaid program. So again, monthly spending on the Medicaid program. The blue represents before the emergency, and the orange represents once the emergency was in place. So the immediate action was, immediate reaction to the federal emergency was that spending decreased as individuals either did not want to go into a place where they thought they might be exposed to COVID, or providers may have canceled non-emergency procedures and such. So initially spending decreased, but has reverted to that pre-COVID trend. But it hasn't exceeded that pre-COVID trend. And so while enrollment increased quite a bit because of continuous enrollment requirement, spending has after drop initially, has come back to where we largely would expect it to be without COVID.
All right. I think we have a question from Representative Galvin.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. I have a question. I think on the previous slide, I was wondering if you have any knowledge of the rest of the states and if they had Medicaid and if that they've had a similar type of trend elsewhere.
Yeah, through the chair. So with the continuous enrollment, every state was affected by this. So across the country, enrollment in Medicaid went up 20 million or so over that period of time. On the spending side of it, I don't know. I'm not sure where that was. A lot of this would have been, initially especially, would have been, managed care would have been involved with a lot of these states. I don't know if the COVID emergency affected those already existing contracts and such. So I don't know on the spending part. But on the enrollment part, definitely increased.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to Mr. Obedin. So on the spending side, is this total federal and state, is this total spend, or is this state spend?
So for the record, Ted Helvoid, and through the chair, this is total spending. Yes, total spending.
So follow up, Madam Chair?
Follow up.
Yeah. Through the chair. So we are effectively incorporating the enhanced FMAP on the slide correct?
Through the chair, yes, that is correct. So this is total spending. This is the blue line and the orange line is total spending. What that overall mix is from let's say 72% before the, or 70% before the emergency, up to 73%, 74% during the emergency, that's all not revealed in this. We'll see that in another 2 slides, though.
Thank you.
All right, so for the record, Ted Helbert with Evergreen Economics. So a little bit of change here, but still talking about COVID. The first bullet, main bullet here, deals with Alaska overall. The second, third bullet focus back on Medicaid. So as one of the requests from the department soon into the COVID emergency was they requested that I provide them with a monthly update on the impact of COVID on the Medicaid program. Then that's kind of morphed into also looking at the state overall. And so one of the things we looked at was, over that period was, looked at how has the state of Alaska compared to peer states. And I define these peer states myself, and I understand it's difficult to do a peer state with Alaska, but I chose Montana, Idaho, North and South Dakota, Wyoming, and New Mexico. These are geographically large states with relatively small populations. Again, not a perfect match to Alaska, but as close as we're going to get in the U.S. After adjusting for differences in populations and in the age distribution of the states, Alaska had 28% fewer hospitalizations across the state. This is beyond the Medicaid program, just across the states, 3,300 fewer hospitalizations than we would have expected had Alaska performed like those peer states. And 22% fewer deaths, so nearly 400 fewer deaths over that period of time. And I show the comparison with the peer states. It also did a comparison with U.S. overall and very similar results. So overall, Alaska performed, exceptionally well with respect to COVID, with especially hospitalizations and with death. So then back down to bullet number two there. So dealing with Medicaid. So in Medicaid, had Alaska performed like its peer states, spending on the Medicaid program would have been about $31 million higher during the COVID emergency. So looking from March through January this year. So not quite 3 years. And general fund spending would have been $5.6 million more over that period. More recently, started also looking at post-COVID conditions, and that is the CMS has created that as a diagnosis now. And so we can track in the data of the number of Alaskans on the Medicaid program diagnosed with post-COVID. There's been about 1,500 so far. Total spending has only been about $4.6 million and less than $1 million in general fund spending. It's kind of for what it's worth, from an economist's point of view, I don't see post-COVID conditions or long COVID having a big impact on the Medicaid program in comparison to many of the chronic conditions that already Medicaid recipients would have and such. But that's something that would be in track just for to understand this. Okay, so to the question of spending, how much has been state and how much has been federal? So we're on slide 11, and the bars show total spending on the Medicaid program for fiscal year 2012 through 2022. The blue shows state spending, and the red portion shows federal spending. And then the total height of the bar is total spending of that. And this is you can see from 2012, if you go from 2012 all the way to 2022, the spending by the state of Alaska has barely changed over that period of time. And it's gone up a little bit, coming back down. And obviously, the additional FMAP provided by the federal government has had a big impact the last few years. Over that period, total spending on Medicaid program increased by $1 billion from 2012 to 2022. Virtually all of that has been funded by the federal government. So that's kind of the big takeaway on growth in the Medicaid program overall has been largely federally funded. The two lines, the green line, the blue line, the green line represents the annual unduplicated count of enrollees in Medicaid program each year, and the blue line represents the annual unduplicated count of recipients in the Medicaid program. And again, the difference in enrollee is anyone who's enrolled at any point in time, all 12 months or just 1 month during that fiscal year. The blue line represents recipients and enrollee who actually used services. In 2012, 88% of Medicaid enrollees were also recipients. So nearly 9 out of 10 Medicaid enrollees were also using services. In 2022, 74% of Medicaid enrollees were using services. So we're down to 1 in 4 Medicaid recipients were not even using services, or 3 in 4 were actually using services. All right, so let's talk about a couple aspects of the actual projection. And I'm not, like I think I mentioned earlier, I'm not going to talk about step by step in the projection. There's lots of information in the report that just I don't want to put you completely to sleep today. So we're going to focus on a couple aspects. Number one is population, and I don't think there's any surprise to anyone here. Alaska's population is projected to grow very slowly over the next 20 years. And the projection I show here is this from the state demographer in the Labor and Workforce Development. between 2023 and 2043, The state demographer expects about 1,000 new, the population increased by about 1,000 people per year. So a very slow growth over the next 20 years. And the state demographer also expects that the number of children in Alaska to decrease over that period of time. So that has obviously fundamental impact on many aspects of life in Alaska, and it certainly has going to impact the Medicaid program. Along with that, the number of adults, of working age adults, say 20 to 64, increasing relatively slowly, 0.18% per year, while the number of seniors, population of seniors, increasing by about 0.81% per year. So almost one new senior per year. Number of children decreasing, working age adults increasing slowly, and relatively rapid growth in the number of seniors. Again, for anyone who's followed Medicaid or understands healthcare spending in general, working age adults are more expensive than children. Seniors are more expensive than working age adults. And so this is going to have an impact on the Medicaid program.
Co-Chair Edgeman.
Just to interject quickly, we've got a publication from our Department of Labor called Alaska Trends, and I read that pretty closely every month that it comes out. Just got a new edition a couple days ago, but the September edition, along with the edition that we just got in our mailboxes here a few days ago, largely agrees with information on this slide, but it differs in some ways. And it's interesting to me that in my memory might be off here a little bit, but my recollection is that the population growth from 2021 to 2050, according to the Department of Labor, in Alaska increases like about 1,500 people, but that the cohort of 14 to 64 actually decreases. And you might check on that. I could be wrong, but that's just from memory. But the differences ultimately aren't significant. Your total population curve is very slight in terms of growing from 2023 to 2043. But I point that out just maybe for something to be noted.
Ted Helvoid, for the record, Ted Helvoid, Evergreen Economics, and through the chair. So the numbers I show here are from the Department of Labor. So I think their most recent long-term population forecast was from this past June, so June 2022. And so these are their data. So, okay, so we're going to jump from population to Medicaid reimbursement rates. So we're on slide 14, and this chart shows year-over-year changes in Medicaid reimbursement rates compared to year-over-year changes in medical price inflation. The Medicaid reimbursement rates is simply the amount paid to providers for services provided by a Medicaid program, and would be a mix of state funds and federal funds. Medical price inflation, on the other hand, is the amount of money paid by consumers, by private citizens, for insurance, for deductibles on services, for co-pays, and for any other out-of-pocket costs for insurance. So medical price inflation does not include Medicaid. Medical price inflation does not include Medicare or any other form of public insurance. So these are important aspects here. These are comparable in the sense that these are providers, these are affecting providers, but they are from two different populations. And so, and we'll see why that's important here in just a moment. So, fiscal year 2016 to 2017, 2017 to 2018, 2018 to 2019, 2019 to 2020, medical price inflation, the amount paid by consumers for their private insurance and for their co-pays and for their deductibles, increased rapidly in Alaska and rapidly across the U.S. But the data show in the blue bars is for the CPI based in Alaska, the Consumer Price Index for medical prices in Alaska. And over that period, on a per-year basis, medical price inflation increased by 3.6% more than Medicaid reimbursement rates. So it's only in the last 2 years, so from fiscal year 2020 to 21 and 21 to 22, that Medicaid reimbursement rates increased slightly faster than medical price inflation, slightly faster in 2021 and by more than just over 1 percentage point in 21 and 22. This matters because as Medicaid reimbursement rates are held down for cost containment, and that's, I think, everyone's on board with cost containments. But as Medicaid reimbursement rates are held down for cost containment efforts, to the extent that providers need more money, it affects the private sector. So it affects the rest of us purchasing insurance, purchasing healthcare and such. And so the in Alaska, medical price inflation is growing faster than we would see on general outside of Alaska. And part of that has to do with the comparison to Medicaid reimbursement rates.
Madam Chair.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, that was a lot to take in. You said it well. I just need to take it in. But a Medicaid provider is providing service for someone who's relatively poor. That's my first thought. They don't have to do that. That's my second thought. In between FY16 and FY20, they were not being paid as well as they have in the last few years relative to inflation. Generally true?
So, through the chair, Representative, what's not shown in here is like the base, what that base is, the base payment is. And it is the fact, if we went back further, the data that are mostly easily available to me are these data, 2016 forward. But if we went back to 2015, 14, 13, 12, the story is the same. The reimbursement rates, Medicaid reimbursement rates were below medical price inflation. But to your point, yes, this would be, if there's some point back in the past where they were the same, let's theorize that they were the same in 2005, what the private payer would pay and the Medicaid, what would be paid for the Medicaid recipient. And again, I'm making that number that year up, 2005. And then we just let them go. The amount paid for the Medicaid recipient is much lower today than what is being paid by that individual with private insurance through an employer or some other source like that, so non-government source. Okay, so that's the history into the future. So the blue line represents that same little history we just looked at, and then the blue dotted line represents my forecast for medical price inflation in Alaska through 2043. And it's going to grow quite a bit. The orange line represents, and I don't want to say so much my forecast, but my assumption of what medical price inflation is going to grow into the future. And what I mean by that is I don't believe Medicaid reimbursement rates are going to increase at the rate they did the last 2 years, because there's going to be the demand of the legislature to keep spending down. So I don't think they're going to increase like they have the last couple of years, but I also conversely do not believe that the department would be in any way able to hold prices essentially flat like they were doing for the years before that. And so my estimate is that they're going to be growing about 1.6% per year, 1.6 to 2% per year over the next 20 years. And this matters a lot. So this is, again, this is built into the forecast. It's more my assumption than a forecast, because this is not a market that we're forecasting. This is the actions of the department dealing with reimbursement rates. But this matters a lot, because a change in that from just an extra percentage point per year dramatically increases what spending is going to be on the Medicaid program 20 years from now. And we'll see that again in a few slides forward here. So,
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, on this topic, you indicated that you believed and this is understandable, of course, you know our fiscal situation probably roughly, that there would be pressure to keep rates down. But rate rebasement is one of the main ways to adjust reimbursement, I assume. And the state was supposed to do that. I think they're supposed to do it every 4 years, and they just didn't do it. So, first of all, I don't know how they're allowed to just not do it. But I'm not sure what my question is other than that. At some point, we would have to, either the administration or the legislature would have to sort of succumb to that fact, I guess, is where I'm going. I mean, we can't just not have rate rebasement forever. Is that fair?
For the record, Ted Helbert, Evergreen Economics, through the chair. Yes, I think that's fair. And I that's not something I'm personally involved with. My understanding is as you mentioned, that there's rates are reviewed depending on, I think kind of, it's like every, depending on what it is, 3 years, 4 years, it's not a consistent across all. And sometimes they increase, sometimes they don't. And often they don't. So, but I do think it's fair to say, for providers that there's a lot of pressures of cost, their cost pressures have only gone up. And so, this is definitely something that is going to be, a hot topic, I guess, over the next few years. So. All right. For the record, Ted Helbert, Evergreen Economics. We're on slide 16. This slide shows, this table shows the projection for total spending broken out by state general fund and other matching funds and federal spending. So in fiscal year 2023, my estimate for total spending is $2.6 million. By 2043, it's going to be about almost $5.3 million. So it's going to double between over those 20 years. So 3.6% overall growth rate. For the feds, it's going to increase by about 3.3%, and for the state, it's going to increase by about 4.2%. That increase, that greater growth rate for the state has everything to do with what's going to start happening April 1st, as that 6.2 percentage point of additional FMAP the feds have been picking up, as that starts going back down to zero over the next three quarters, that's going to be the impact. That's that additional growth rate for the state. And so that 4.2% that I kind of spread out through 2043 is going to happen very quickly. It's going to happen in the next couple of years. And the fact is, for my forecast, and this is a long-term forecast, so I'm not so focused on next year and the following year. It's really those long-term trends. But for just from 2023 to 2024, my forecast is that spending is going to increase by about $184 million total spending, and about $95 million of that is going to be state spending. And that is just the natural increase for the state, as well as that shift in that 6.2 percentage points from the Fed back to the states. So it's going to be a big chunk in the next couple of years, especially this next year. Okay. And so the final slide for this section, for the forecast is slide 17, and this shows the different components of the forecast we just looked at. And so the blue bar at the bottom represents spending in 2023, and this imagines that the Medicaid recipients as they are today is not going to change, they're not going to age, you're just going to keep on spending the same. So, and of course that's not going to happen, but this would be if just the status quo over the next 20 years. And then each of the bars above there represents the areas of growth in the Medicaid program. That very thin gray bar right above, gray or tan bar, represents population growth, very thin. But population will grow a little bit over this period, so there will be a little growth in spending due to population. Above that is green enrollment growth above population growth. So the enrollment, the proportion of individuals in Alaska by age cohort, gender, whatever you choose, has increased over time. It's going to continue to increase slowly over time. And so that green represents growth in enrollment above population growth. The brown portion represents utilization of Medicaid services. Excuse me. And for there's a lot of different ways to define utilization of Medicaid services or medical services in general. For the forecast, we think of utilization as being of all the services that are available to an individual. So within the forecast, there's hundreds and hundreds of services that an individual has access to. We categorize that into 20 different service groups. Again, this is all in the report. And those could be such like really big ones, important ones like inpatient hospital, outpatient hospital and such, nursing homes and stuff. And then there's other ones that are much smaller. The utilization of Medicaid services, the number of different services that an individual actually uses has increased over time. And this is partly the aging of the population. Children don't touch as many services as working-age adults. Working-age adults don't touch as many services as seniors. And so with the change with that growth in population, the number of different services people are going to use is going to increase. And that's represented by that brown band. The blue just above that is the intensity of use of Medicaid services. And so people are just going to use a little bit more services, continue. So that kind of so we've got that. And then finally, the light red or mauve, I guess, color is growth in reimbursement rates of services provided by Medicaid. So this is that very slow growth that I'm assuming in Medicaid reimbursement rates. That's how it shows up in the forecast. So the most significant cost driver in the Medicaid program is something that I'm assuming is not going to grow very rapidly. So if we assume that Medicaid reimbursement rates are going to grow at the rate of medical price inflation in Alaska, the forecast for 2043 would be at least $2 billion higher than we're seeing right here. So this is the huge, whatever this monkey in the room or a grill in the room, whatever it is like that, is really the Medicaid reimbursement rates. And so that the providers have to be paid, but as rates go up, they have a big impact, and they go up again and again and again. It's just the power of compounding interest. So it's a pretty graph, but also kind of a scary one, I guess.
All right. We have a couple questions. Representative Stapp, followed by Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to Mr. Holowide. So obviously, as we head into FY24, our state OMB is basically budgeting, I think, $42.5 million to offset increased utilization, the end of enhanced FMAP, and, of course, the redetermination process for this fiscal year's Medicaid increase. So my question to you is, given those factors and your extensive analysis through Evergreen Economics, how accurate do you believe the $42 million increase projection is from our perspective?
So through the record, Ted Helbert, Evergreen Economics, for the chair. So my forecast is that overall spending is going to increase, I think, by $184 million, and that state spending is going to increase by $97 million. So that is some of that, not all of that. Some of that would happen regardless of the shifting of that 6.2 percentage points of FMAP. And so my guess is it would probably be maybe 50 to 55 million would be the growth in Medicaid, and then the rest would be the part would be that shifting back of the FMAP.
So follow up, Madam Chair. Yeah, so just for the record, the discrepancy we have is basically by your projections, it's more like $90 million, and from OMB, it's more like $45 million. So
through the record, it's not clear to me, is the OMB estimate for just the component?
Or all. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you. Through the chair, Dr. Halvin, I wondered if you would help me understand the population we're talking about. We have 736,000 Alaskans presently, more or less, due to expected to grow, it looks like, a little bit to 744. Of this number, how many are on Medicaid now? I didn't see that in the presentation.
So through the chair, on Medicaid today, mm-hmm. I wrote that down somewhere. Fiscal year 2022, the last complete year, this is annual unduplicated count. So month to month, this varies, but unduplicated count, 277,000. So 38% of the population.
Okay, through the chair, if I may, and a follow-up with this. So has there been any thought that if our overall economy shifts, as we know, there's due to be a big influx, let's say, almost similar to the 70s, the late 70s. Let's say there are big projects going on. Lots more people ideally are working. I know that we probably won't have a shift in our seniors, but I'm just wondering if you could give us any sense that that 38% may shift positively in the sense that we may have fewer on Medicaid, and if you've done any thinking along those lines.
So for the record, Ted Helber, Evergreen Economics, and through the chair. So so first off, that 38% is going to shift over the next year during mm-hmm. During redetermination. So this is going to get back down to around 34%. And so over the, it'll probably won't be done in a year. It's going to probably take a couple of years to do this. Because this is going to be, and this is not Alaska thing, this is going to be every state. This is going to be a big task to get through this. So it's going to get down to about 34%. And I want to reemphasize that that there's not everyone on Medicaid is using services. So they're on Medicaid, and it's going to get down, you know, once this gets done, there's going to be about 84%. My guess is about 84% of Medicaid enrollees are going to be recipients. To your question of can we fix or can we really help the Medicaid program by building up the economy? I mean, my guess as an economist, I sure hope so. So I think that the Medicaid program should not be divorced from the local or the state economy. But I will also caution that the if you look at, because we have a lot of data now, if you look at these year by year by year, the biggest impacts on Medicaid enrollment in Alaska or anywhere has a lot less to do with the economy than it does to do with federal policy, per se. So it's definitely the case that a stronger economy can get people off Medicaid, but also a strong economy can help finance Medicaid. So what's left? So it's kind of in both ways that can help the program. So.
Thank you.
Yeah. Right. So, excuse me. So for the record, Ted Helbert with Evergreen Economics, and we're going to shift gears again to chronic conditions and Medicaid. And this is back to that thinking about the cost curve. So the chronic conditions are a big driver that's pushing the cost curve in the wrong direction, I guess. So what is a chronic condition? Let's start with what an acute condition is. An acute condition develops or occurs quickly, lasts a short period of time. You get the flu, you break your arm, that's an acute condition. It happens, you get over it. Chronic condition typically occurs gradually and persists for many months or years, and then it could be related to things such as lifestyle, drug use, alcohol abuse, obesity, tobacco use. It could be some environmental factors that affect certain things as cancers and asthma, and it could be also congenital disorders, so such as cystic fibrosis, Down syndrome. So it's a real mix, and these within the, and I don't differentiate in my analysis, but there's modifiable and non-modifiable chronic conditions. And that's one of the things that was asked me for the next long-term forecast is to look at these separately, the chronic conditions that are modifiable versus those that are non-modifiable, which I think is a great idea to do that. So moving to slide 20. So first, the good news, most Medicaid recipients do not have a chronic condition. And we're going to get to the bad news in just a moment. As you might imagine, the likelihood of being diagnosed with a chronic condition increases with age. So in figure 20 shows the Medicaid recipients under 15, 15 to 24, and then age groups all the way up to 85 plus. Proportionally, very few children, so 15 or under 15, have a chronic condition. But as we move up into adults and such, the proportion's increasing over time. Increasing likelihood.
May I just quickly? I just want to on your data here. Is this Alaska Medicaid recipients? And I guess if you aren't speaking to Alaskan Medicaid recipients, would you just make note so I can follow that?
Yes, through the chair. My apologies. Yes, this is Alaska Medicaid recipients fiscal year 2022. So actual data for 2022.
Correct. Madam Chair.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair. What do we make of the senior, your three last blocks? These would be folks that would qualify for Medicare as well. So are these conditions that are not Medicare eligible and therefore there's still some Medicaid contribution the state must pay? Is that?
Yeah, excellent question. Through the chair, Representative, great question. So for at 65 individuals, and we'll see this in the next slide much more clearly, at age 65, many people on Medicaid lose Medicaid coverage. So if you're on Medicaid because Medicaid expansion, your eligibility ends when you turn 65 and you would transition to Medicare. For other eligibilities, you turn 65, you may stay on Medicaid, and then the Medicaid program pays your premiums for Medicare and you're now referred to as dual eligible or duly eligible. Medicare takes the role of a primary payer. And we'll see the impact of that. But Medicaid is still involved in your, as you also see, Medicaid is still a big part of your, of the spending. And that is one shortcoming in my analysis is I have data on Medicaid. I have the Medicare data not accessible at all. So we only see the Medicaid side of individuals in here. So let's go to the next slide just to kind of emphasize this. So slide 21 shows the prevalence of the diagnosis of a chronic condition by age. And this takes all 12 age groups that I use for the Medicaid program. So under 10 years of age, less than 10% of Medicaid recipients have a diagnosed chronic condition. And as we go up, it just goes up through 55 to 64. And then it drops precipitously for that 65 to 74 year age group. And so this is two things are happening. We're losing people that were, thankfully for the Medicaid program, we're losing people that were enrolled through Medicaid expansion and some other eligibilities, and they migrated completely to Medicare. But then those that are still on Medicaid are now duly eligible. The Medicaid program pays their deductibles. And so we still see some that have a diagnosed chronic condition, but the only way we can tell if they have a diagnosed chronic condition is through the data, through the actual data. Do we see diagnoses in there for the individual? And so that drops off there. And so they're still going to be there. They're likely still going to be there, but they're getting a lot of their services through the Medicare program, and their diagnosis of that chronic condition is through the Medicare program. So, okay. And then as you can see, for 75 to 84, 85 plus, it starts coming back. I think this is really kind of an important way to think about this. It's really common to think about that medical costs in general increase with age, but in fact, what's happening is the prevalence of chronic conditions increases with age. So the longer you live, the more chance you have to pick up a chronic condition through lifestyle, through environment, through bad luck, any number of ways to pick up a chronic condition, then a second, a third, fourth. And there are many individuals that with chronic conditions in the Medicaid program that have four, five, six, seven, eight chronic conditions. And so, when we talk about that the seniors are more expensive than children and more expensive than working age adults for medical care, what we're saying is they're more likely to have chronic conditions, diagnosed chronic conditions, which makes them more expensive. So in slide 22, again, the data are Alaska Medicaid program, fiscal year 2022. Column A is our 12 different age cohorts. Column B shows the average Medicaid spending for an individual in that age cohort. And so for those under five, average spending is about $8,000, and it grows through till we get to 85 plus, it's about $48,000 per individual. Column C shows spending by age cohort. So we're still on figure 22. So column C shows spending per recipient within the age cohort that do not have a, for individuals who do not have a diagnosed chronic condition. And so what's to me is stunning about this is that except for very young children, which could have, they tend to have some, a few have high expenses that very early on. And then for seniors, spending does not differ by age. So for individuals without chronic condition, their Medicaid spending just doesn't differ. So it's essentially independent of age. So what's not independent, of course, is chronic conditions. So if we go to column D, now looks at average spending per recipient for those with one or more diagnosed chronic conditions. And doesn't matter if you're 15 to 19 or 55 to 64. It's very expensive. So the extent to which individuals have one, two, three, four chronic conditions, that's what's driving spending on the Medicaid program. I noted at the beginning that most Medicaid recipients do not have a chronic condition, and this has been relatively consistent over the last 4 or 5 years. Of the roughly 200,000 Medicaid recipients from 2022, about 50,000 had one or more diagnosed chronic conditions. They represented most of the spending on the Medicaid program. And so this figure 23, or slide 23, shows the Medicaid forecast from 2023 to 2043. And again, increasing from about $2.6 billion up to about $5.3 billion over that period of time, so just about doubling. And instead of showing it by the state portion and the federal portion, this shows it by spending on those without a chronic condition and those with a chronic condition. And so the orange represents spending on Medicaid recipients or beneficiaries without diagnosed chronic conditions, and the blue represents those spending on recipients with one or more diagnosed chronic conditions. Today, 77% of spending on the Medicaid program are for those with chronic conditions, and it's going to increase to 82% by 2043. And that 82% is actually I think of as being a lower bound. This forecast only incorporates changes in demographics with respect to increasing the prevalence of chronic conditions. In other words, it assumes that the prevalence within any age group or any age group or gender and such like that does not increase. It's just the change in the number of individuals in those age groups. And so as people age, but it's the driver. It's the driver of Medicaid spending today. It's going to be a bigger driver of Medicaid spending in 2043. Okay. So I'm in the last section here, and this is a focus on the Healthy Alaskans 2030. And the Healthy Alaskans is the state health improvement plan. It's not something that I am personally involved with at all. Beginning with the forecast, the long-term forecast from last year and then continued this year, the department asked me to look at the Healthy Alaskans 2030 plan and essentially do some scenario analysis of how if the state's goals within Healthy Alaska can be reached, and those goals positively affected the Medicaid program, what could be the savings in the Medicaid program? And so within the 30 health objectives in the Healthy Alaska 2030 plan, There's one that deals with cancer mortality. There's one that deals with healthy weight for children. And keep in mind, so there's a 20-year forecast. So every child on Medicaid today, if they're on Medicaid in the future, 20 years from now, they're all going to be adults. So it's 20 years is seemed like a lot of time before, but it's getting shorter, I guess. And then objective 14, for adults with mental illness, so mentally unhealthy days. Objective 22 and 23 within the Healthy Alaskan deals with alcohol and drug abuse, and objective 26 and 27 deals with Tabasco use amongst adolescents and adults. So of those 30 objectives, there are 7 that I focused on, and each of those 7 objectives can be linked to a specific chronic condition. And the report has way more detail than I want to talk about, but there's a lot of chronic conditions that are looked at. I focused on these 5, and so cancer, obesity, mental health conditions, drug and alcohol dependency, and tobacco use. All I'm doing is doing the analysis or doing the scenario analysis of saying if Healthy Alaskan objectives can be met, and if meeting those objectives over 10 years, and I just extended for 20, if those same kind of objectives can affect the Medicaid, can affect these chronic conditions, the prevalence of these chronic conditions, what would be the savings to the Medicaid program? So if you go to slide 27, focus on these 5 different chronic conditions. If the prevalence of these chronic conditions can be decreased just at these very slight rates, which is still a substantial improvement, but these slight rates over time shows estimates of the savings to the total Medicaid program as well as general fund spending for fiscal year 28, 33, 38, and 43 by 2043, meeting those objectives. It's not exceeding them, just meeting those objectives and holding those gains could result in more than $400 million in savings to the Medicaid program by 2043. And that's savings over my baseline forecast, and $120 million in state general fund savings. And both those represent about 8% savings from that baseline projection of $5.3 million. All right, and that's all I have. So,
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to Mr. Helveit. So thank you so much for the presentation. I just have a couple of quick questions. So we talked about the kind of progressive growth in state funding of Medicaid. We talked about Medicaid reimbursement rates under fee-for-service. I am curious, how many states augment the cost of those types of programs with a Medicaid provider tax? Do you know about that?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, I don't know what proportion of states do that. I know that is a thing, but I do not know what proportion of states do that.
Co-Chair Edgman.
Yes, can you just sort of briefly kind of sketch out where Alaska sits in comparison to other states? You've given us a lot of information here, so I'm not expecting too much detailed analysis, but of our 740,000 residents, 262, whatever the number is, 63, was on Medicaid. Is that an inordinate number, and is the composition of the age graphic sort of typical of another state?
Yeah. So for the record, Ted Helveit, Evergreen Economics, and through the chair, Representative Edmund. So great question. So the proportion of the population on Medicaid is a little bit higher in Alaska than other states. There's a couple reasons for that. And one of the big ones is it would be comparing the clearest comparison would be Alaska to other states that did Medicaid expansion. So that obviously increased a lot of people, you know, the Medicaid rolls quite a bit. And so when I'm not sure what the rate is right now with the contingent enrollment requirement from the feds, but as this unwinds, the my expectation is there's going to be 34% of Alaskans will be enrolled in Medicaid at some point. That, so again, that annual unduplicated count will be about 34%. If we thought about this in average monthly enrollment, it's going to be closer to 32% probably. The year before pandemic, across the country, about 30% of Americans were on Medicaid. And so it's a few percentage points higher for Alaska.
Yeah, just a quick sort of comment. I think we're in the top 9 states in the country in terms of Medicaid usage. But I really appreciate the presentation today. Lots of information, very illuminating in a number of ways, looking forward in time, and certainly the aging population in Alaska is to be concerning. I would look forward to next year's presentation. And if we had, and we're out of time, everybody's getting weary around the table, but would love to pepper you with more questions. Are you around for the next couple of days?
I am actually flying out tomorrow, but I'm also very available. So if you have questions that you can talk to Courtney about, I'm happy to either on a phone call or respond to questions in email, either one. So.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. And in light of the fact that you can follow up and ask more questions as they come to you, but we do have a question from Representative Josephson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, Dr. Helvoit. The end of the freezing of the rolls, essentially the freezing of the rolls and adding others, I guess. But now that we're into redeterminations is where I'm going. And I understand the need to do that because the COVID emergency is ending, thankfully. There will be folks, I'm just thinking about behavior, there will be folks who will be fine with being dropped from the rolls because they're employed, they have other insurance. Perhaps they made it rich and they can purchase insurance, unlikely. There will be others who will postpone treatment and may not survive that experience, or they'll go to an emergency room because that's the place where when the bill comes, you know, it could affect your credit rating, but you can sort of just ignore it. And am I right that those expenses then typically get passed on to all the other payers in the system?
So for the record, Ted Helvoit with Everett Economics through the chair. So there's a lot in that, kind of in that question. My expectation would be, first of all, the fact that 25% of individuals on Medicaid right now are not using services, to me, suggests a lot of people don't know they're on Medicaid or don't care they're on Medicaid because they have insurance somewhere else. But I certainly think there are people that are on Medicaid, maybe not care they're on Medicaid, but it's nice to have when you need it, for sure. It's definitely a case that individuals, they lose Medicaid coverage, that it would be the emergency room would be where they go for medical care. It's very likely, though, that those same individuals would have done that, gone that same route if they're on a Medicaid program because they didn't know. There's a lot of, and it's a small cohort that don't see a primary care provider. They go to the emergency room. And so you see this again and again and again. And so I don't know that that's going to spur additional use of emergency rooms. It's going to have an impact on the cost structure for the cost of hospitals. However, there's also the DSH payments, the disproportional share hospital payments that goes to hospitals that covers that. This is from the gentleman I worked with on the original forecast back in 2005, 2006 on a project we worked together in Washington. It was very enlightening to me that his comment was that many hospitals love the uninsured because they can They can bill them full rates way above what they would charge Medicaid, Medicare, or private insurance. They either bankrupt them, which I shouldn't say that, but they get paid somewhat there. Then they write off the rest that gets, they get compensated through the DSH payments, or the disproportionate share hospital payments. Doesn't sound very pretty, but I don't have, I can't show you, I don't think any hospital is going to show you that. But there is, yeah, I think there's some truth in that, with the ACA, those were supposed to disappear. The disproportionate share hospital payments were supposed to disappear. They never have. So they still exist in Alaska. They still exist across the country. And so hospitals are compensated for that care.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Johnson, through the chair. Of those on Medicaid, what do they contribute to their care, through things like deductibles, copays? Is that a number that you track? And can I get a little information on that?
So for the record, Ted Helbert, Evergreen Economics, through the chair, Representative. My understanding is nothing. I do not believe that in Alaska that there is any payment from the enrollees. So, but if there is, I'm not aware of that. So.
Can I get a follow-up?
Follow-up.
So is it that they can't charge like a copay or a deductible, or I guess maybe that's just out of your knowledge? Is there any way to get information on that?
So through the chair, there would be not something I would focus on. But, some in the department could help you with that. I do know, at the federal level, states' work requirements, copay requirements like that are often being floated by states. I think of Indiana and Kentucky being a couple, and I don't think they've been successful at maintaining those. So, and I'd be happy to do a little research on that. But someone in the department may know that cold and not need to research it.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
It was quite a lot
to absorb, and I would encourage anyone to follow up if they have an opportunity or if they have some questions. Thank you for your presentation, and I don't know, do you have any closing remarks that you'd like to make?
No, just thank you. It's been a nice sunny day in Juneau. So.
All right. Well, we have our next meet. Let's see. Our next House Finance meeting will be scheduled for Thursday, March 9th, 2023, at 1:30 p.m. We will be hearing House Bill 62, the Renewable Energy Grant Fund, and taking public testimony. And with no further business before the committee, at 3:38, we are adjourned.